last exam was Thursday, that's the last exam, so this one is going to be Tuesday, that's the last exam. So if you guys can make it on that Tuesday, send me an email, and then I'll send you guys the mock exam PDF the day before we take the mock exam. Okay? The review will be on the 18th, on the same day as, do you guys know about that earthquake drill?
On the 18th, yeah, there's an earthquake drill in the morning, maybe around 10:15 or so. Should be done before lecture. But since we're talking about that, if the great shakeout is not done before 11:30 when we're supposed to start lecture, please come into class whenever it is done, and we'll have even a little bit of lecture on that day. Even if we can't start right on time, I'd rather start late rather than miss a whole class session. But I think we should be able to start on time.
Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so on the screen, we see our schedule, and today is the 9th. We're going to start nervous system today. That's chapter 7. So, welcome. This is Bio 241, and it is October 9th. We're going to start chapter 7, nervous system, today. And there is an extra credit lab assignment this week to draw an action potential. We're going to go over an action potential in lecture, and you go over it in lab again. So you have until the end of lab to draw that out for 1 point extra credit. So what else we see on the schedule is that we do have our second exam on October 23rd, and that is 2 weeks away, exactly from today. All right, so we had the first two exams on a Tuesday, and I don't know, do we always have it on a Tuesday? No, we have it on Thursdays the rest of the time. Okay, so that's the deal. Any questions on the schedule at all? Doing pretty good? Okay, all your lectures are online. I'll be getting some lab grades from lab instructors real soon, so I can put those into Blackboard so you can calculate what your overall score is. And of course, see me during my office hours if you want me to calculate what you have to do in this class to get an A, B, C, or D. And it's just a little mathematical formula. I'll show you how to use that mathematical formula if you don't already know. And you can calculate exactly where you stand in the class. Bless you. Any questions? No? Okay. I think I can get away with just one screen today. All right, so we're going to start looking at the nervous system. The first part of this chapter pretty much is anatomy. I think I'm going to go over it fairly quickly. Hopefully I will be able to. But I lost my cursor. What happened to it? Come on back here. It is visible. Ah, good. Oh, it's just on the other screen. I turned the other screen off. Never mind. Okay, so nervous system. If we think of the whole nervous system inside your body, we can divide it into two general locations. And these two general locations are the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Furthermore, you should know how we define these two different parts of your anatomy. The central nervous system is made of your brain and spinal cord. It's surrounded by the meninges, all right? So it's surrounded by the cranium and the vertebral column. That's your central nervous system. Everything else is the peripheral nervous system. Everything outside the CNS is the peripheral nervous system, including cranial nerves, spinal nerves, all the nerves in your body, plus special receptors that connect up to these nerves are considered part of the peripheral nervous system. And furthermore, if we look at nervous tissue, we can break it down into two categories, two kinds of cells. So the whole nervous system we can break down into two categories, and then if we think at a cellular level, if we look at a cell, we can classify it as being one of two different kinds. And the first kind is called a neuron. A neuron is specialized for transmitting information very rapidly over long distances. The other kind of nerve cell or nervous system cell is what we call a support cell or a neuroglia cell. These do not transmit electrical impulses, right, but they help support the job of the neurons. So let's start with neurons and then talk about neuroglial cells. All right, so neurons gather and transmit information by responding to stimuli. Right, they produce and send electrical chemical impulses very rapidly over long distances, and they communicate with other cells by releasing chemical signaling molecules at their axon terminus, so they can pass information on to other cells. Another important function of a neuron that's not on your list right here is that it can integrate information. All right, so a neuron can receive a number of different types of signals and add all of that information up and make a decision on what to do. So we call that integration. So neurons, let's look at the shape of a neuron. I got a couple of different neurons right here. But there are three basic structures on a neuron. There are some very short processes. We call these dendrites. So a process is just a projection coming off of a neuron. And the function of a dendrite right here is to receive signals. It receives signals. And you might just want to jot down right here, it receives signals because it has ligand-gated channels. And you probably have no idea what that is right now, but that's okay because we're going to talk about it in this class. Ligand-gated channels and dendrites for receiving. So you could think of these dendrites right here as like being an antenna on a TV or a radio. I don't know, anybody have any antennas anymore right now? We all have cable and wireless satellite communications, but someplace, even in your cell phone, there is an antenna, though you don't see it anymore. It's hidden in there, right? And that's for what? Receiving signals because of ligand-gated channels. Then we have the cell body. Sometimes we call that the soma. This is where most of the living processes of this neuron take place. It supports all the processes that happen in the dendrites and in the axon, and it contains the nucleus and organelles. So we find mitochondria in this area here for making what? Making water? Making CO2? No, making ATP, right? The energy currency inside the cell. All right, so that's the cell body. And then there's another projection. Usually there's one, sometimes there's two. And this projection is very long. This could be even a meter long. So even though the cell is microscopic, you need a microscope to see it, the axon is extremely long. It's so thin that you can't see it, but if it was thick enough to see, it would be extremely long on the cellular level. And this is what we call an axon. An axon doesn't receive information, typically, right? It sends information. And it sends information from the cell body down to the axon terminus that we see right over here. And maybe you can see little swellings on the ends of these axons. And we're going to call that a terminal button or an axon terminus or a bouton terminale or a terminal button or a terminal swelling. It has all kinds of different names, but it contains neurotransmitter. It contains vesicles with neurotransmitter in it. We're going to look at that in some detail. So information flows in a neuron in one direction. It always flows from dendrites over the cell body and then down the axon to the axon terminus. And information can't flow backwards. Okay, it's sort of like a dogma in neurophysiology. Neurons can send information only in one direction. So if you have a nerve, a peripheral nerve in your body, say in your arm, and it's going to transmit signals from the central nervous system to the tip of your finger, neurons have to be pointed in one direction. But what can you tell me about the tip of your finger? You have receptors there for pain and temperature, and those signals do go to your brain, but it has to use a different neuron that's turned around that goes in the opposite direction. So you have the bidirectional orientation of these neurons in nerves so nerves can transmit information from the periphery into the CNS or from the CNS into the periphery by turning these neurons around. This kind of neuron that we see is what we call a multipolar neuron that has a bunch of short dendrites and one long axon. Here is a bipolar neuron that we see in the second case, and we have one axon that comes out from the cell body and it bifurcates, and part of this axon has the receiving end, and then the other end is the sending end. All right, so the top neuron is a good example of a motor neuron or an association neuron. The pseudo-unipolar neuron is a good example of a sensory neuron. So I do want you to know the function associated with these different shapes. So number one up here, number A, all right, so this is a motor neuron, and B is going to be a sensory neuron. We'll look at a little bit more detail. The cell body is the nutritional center, makes all the macromolecules that the neuron needs. We might have a group of these nerve cell bodies someplace in the central nervous system, so it's a special little hub of activity. We call that a nucleus, right? So a nucleus could have a lot of different meanings in this class. So the nucleus means the center inside the cell that contains genetic information. The nucleus is also the center of an atom that contains neutrons and protons. But the nucleus, in terms of neuroanatomy, is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites located someplace in the central nervous system. Okay, there could be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system, but we're not going to call that a nucleus, we're going to call that a ganglion. And most textbooks are caught up with this modern nomenclature, except for the anatomy book that we use here at Cypress College, because there is a spot in the brain that book calls the basal ganglia, right? In modern terminology, that should be called the basal nuclei, but not everybody calls it that just yet. But try to remember that a nucleus is a group of these things inside the central nervous system, and then if you have a group of these things in the peripheral nervous system, we call it a ganglia, but you might have to be light on your feet to follow everybody's conversation because it's more of a modern terminology. All right, so dendrites receive information and send it into the cell body because they have, it's written down right here, that's nice, ligand-gated channels. Well, so we're talking about a special protein that's in the membrane that can open and close to certain ions, and that changes the membrane potential when these ion channels open. And the ligand right here, a ligand is a small molecule that binds to something else. Right, and so a ligand is a small molecule that binds to a channel that can either open or close a channel. That's what a ligand is, like a ligature. Axons, on the other hand, conduct electrical impulses away from the cell body because they have a different kind of membrane protein. Oh, and I forgot to mention it, but I'm glad it's on this slide. It has voltage-gated channels. So axons have voltage-gated channels. Dendrites have ligand-gated channels. That just means that channels on dendrites can open or close when they bind a signaling molecule on the outside of the cell, while ion channels in the membrane of axons can open and close based on the voltage that is seen across the membrane. So these are sensitive to voltage. The ones on dendrites are sensitive to binding to a receptor, a ligand binding to a receptor. And you have a nice diagram in your study guide that labels a neuron in a number of different ways, the receiving end, the sending end, and also by different proteins that are found in the cell membrane that you should start practicing right away. It's not a figure that's in your book. Okay, so you can see also on this diagram that there's an arrow. And what can you tell me about this arrow? It is just pointing in one direction, right? It's not a bidirectional arrow. And signals always go from dendrites to cell body down an axon. That's right. Okay. So axons are extremely long in terms of a cellular level. It's kind of unheard of. Usually cells are maybe 10, 20, 30 microns in length, but neurons, the axon could be a meter in length. So there has to be a way for material to move from the cell body down to an axon tip. And diffusion would just be too slow because it's such a huge distance. So there are two kinds of mechanisms for moving things from the cell body, which is the metabolic hub of the cell, down to the axon terminus. And these things are axoplasmic flow and axonal transport, two different kinds of mechanisms. Axoplasmic flow moves components toward the nerve endings via a contraction of the axon. So it acts almost like peristalsis, almost like your digestive system. So neurons actually have this peristalsic move to them that causes axoplasmic flow, that causes cytoplasm to flow out to the tips of all the different processes. Okay, and then there's axonal transport, which is a little bit different. It moves large molecules and insoluble compounds, and maybe even organelles, small organelles, bidirectionally along a microtubule system. But that's one thing that we learned about microtubules already, and that is it's kind of like a railway system inside the cell. Not only do microtubules define the shape of the cell, but it can act as a transport system, a railway or a monorail system inside the cell. So there are two different ways things can move. They can move from the cell body to an extremity in the cell, like an axon terminus or a dendritic terminus. And when things move away from the cell body, okay, down to the end, we call that anterograde transport. Anterograde means going in the forward direction from the cell body out to the periphery of that cell. And there is a little motor protein that attaches to whatever compound is being moved and then also attaches to a microtubule and moves it along the microtubule. That little motor protein is called a kinesin. So a kinesin, you should know, is for anterograde or forward direction of moving compounds along a microtubule. Right? But it's just as important to be able to move materials from an axon terminus to the cell body. And we call that retrograde transport. And retrograde is just the proper term for things moving in what direction? If we're just going to use a common term. Backwards, right? So forward is anterograde, retrograde is backwards. All right, so retrograde, and it uses a different kind of motor protein, and it's called a dynein. So two different kinds of motor proteins will operate with microtubules to move things around inside the cell bidirectionally. Right, but remember that a neuron can only transmit information from a dendrite to a cell body down the axon. But things have to move inside that cell bidirectionally in order for a neuron to behave properly. And some viruses and other toxins, well, viruses by evolution have figured out a way to use these dynein molecules to actually distribute themselves throughout the whole cell, and when it infects an axon terminus, that's how a virus and the genetic information can actually make its way from an axon terminus all the way into the cell body and infect the or transform a nucleus within that neuron, because a virus by itself would not be able to do that. Okay, so let's look at some of the functional and structural classification of neurons. All right, so we're still with neurons. We're not talking about neuroglia just yet. The three kinds of functions that we see in neurons, first is sensory, and another name for sensory is afferent. And you can say afferent, but that's mispronouncing a little bit. Usually we just say afferent, but during lecture I want to make sure people can understand what I'm saying, so I say afferent. And then motor, okay, is another name for motor is efferent. Sometimes we call that efferent, right, an efferent. And an afferent neuron takes information from receptors to the central nervous system that we see on this slide right here. So on this slide, we see kind of an area that has a blue background and kind of a beige background. Is that close? Yeah, okay. So that just signifies the blue background is central nervous system, and here I see an illustration of a spinal cord, and that's part of the central nervous system. Right, then over here I don't see any brain or spinal cord, so that means this is the peripheral nervous system. That's what that background color means. And here we see that pseudo-unipolar neuron, and you have receptors on the dendrites, and that sends information into the central nervous system, so that is an afferent pathway. As a matter of fact, even in your first lab, we talked about different pathways, right, in terms of the baroreceptor reflex and things like that. So this kind of neuron right here, a sensory neuron, sometimes we find it, or a part of this neuron we see in the peripheral nervous system, but a part of it is also in the central nervous system because it enters the central nervous system. So even though there is one long axon, we do give it different names because we see it in two different locations. The receiving part over here is what we call the peripheral process because it's in where? The peripheral nervous system. And then here is the central process because it enters the central nervous system. It's not the central process because it's located centrally on the neuron. It's the central process because it's the part of this neuron that actually enters the central nervous system. So the pseudo-unipolar neuron is actually found in the CNS and the PNS, right? It lives in both locations. An efferent neuron is sort of similar, but it's going to carry information the opposite way. It doesn't have dendrites in the peripheral nervous system. It has dendrites in the central nervous system. That's the receiving end. And it sends signals out into the peripheral nervous system via this one long axon. So this is what we call a multipolar neuron. And a multipolar is always going to be motor or efferent. Okay, and here it says somatic motor neuron. It says somatic motor, okay, but it could also be an autonomic neuron, autonomic nervous system. Here it says somatic because if we look at the effector, we see that it's going to skeletal muscles. All right, so skeletal muscles are superficial in your body compared to visceral organs that are contained in cavities. And so the part of your body that contains muscles and all those nerves, we call that more like the somatic part of your body or the body part of your body. I know that kind of sounds funny. As opposed to the visceral part of your body, which is contained in cavities. All right, and so the somatic motor neuron goes to things that you have voluntary control of. Namely is what? Skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is the only thing you have voluntary control of. Though your visceral organs are controlled by nerves, that is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. And here I see some motor neurons. These are multipolar neurons once again, but in an autonomic pathway, just a review from anatomy, it requires two neurons to get to the effector organ. For somatic motor pathway, it's just one from the central nervous system all the way to a skeletal muscle, but for an autonomic pathway, there are two. So this is, there's going to be a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the peripheral nervous system. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion. So on this illustration, I just see one nerve cell body, but there's going to be thousands, right, in some location in your body that's carrying information to a particular organ. And so the first neuron is what we call the preganglionic neuron. The second one is what we call the postganglionic neuron because it takes two neurons for an autonomic motor pathway. So the effectors for somatic motor will be skeletal muscles. The effectors for autonomic pathways are going to be smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Right? And those things you can't control. Maybe with some meditative techniques or something, you can influence them, but you can't really control them. You can cause a skeletal muscle to relax, but you can't cause your heart to stop and relax like a skeletal muscle. All right. But, for instance, I might be able to say something like, how about if we have a pop quiz for course points right now? So put all your books away, turn your cell phones off. What happened to your heart rate? So it probably went up, right? So you don't have direct control over your heart rate, but your instructor does, right? Or you can do different things, right, to influence these different glands and smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, but you can't control it just like skeletal muscle. The third kind of neuron that we see, not on this illustration right here, which is too bad, is an association neuron. And an association neuron is going to be a multipolar neuron, just like a motor neuron, but it's going to be found completely within the central nervous system. Part of it won't be in the central nervous system and part in the peripheral nervous system that we see with all these other examples right here. Association or interneuron is going to be between neurons within the central nervous system. So if you want to draw it in on your slide, you can go ahead and do that. So it's located entirely within the central nervous system. All right, so here are the neurons by shape once again. Pseudo-unipolar, and this is for an afferent signal pathway. Here is a multipolar neuron. This is for a motor pathway or interneurons within the central nervous system. And then we have a third kind that we haven't talked about yet, a bipolar. And a bipolar is used for special senses. It's going to be used for eyes and ears and things like that, but very limited, and smell, but very limited location. So it's a special kind of sensory neuron, and it's sort of a pun because maybe you know something about special senses versus general senses. Right? Special senses will be like olfaction, vision, hearing, right? And that's where we find these bipolar neurons. Okay, multipolar are always going to be motor. All right, so that's it for neurons, some general shapes. So I do want you to be able to recognize their shape and tell me what their function is. Probably have a flash quiz on that. So the second kind of cell that we have that make up nervous tissue are what we call support cells, or glial cells, or sometimes even neuroglia cells. And they're going to be associated with neurons one way or another. And there are a number of different kinds that you should be able to recognize by their shape. And guess what that means? If these cells have different shapes, they have Different functions, right. So I want you to be able to identify these cells by shape and then also understand what their function is, what the difference in their function. So here we have a neuron in this nice gold color, and all the different parts of the neuron are nicely labeled. Here's the nucleus. Where do we find the nucleus? In the cell body. What's another name for body? Soma, sure. And so here is the soma of this neuron. Then we have some short projection dendrites. The dendrite is what end of a neuron? Functionally, it's the receiving end. Okay, and then here's a very long projection. This is the sending end of the neuron. This is the axon. Okay, so that's a neuron. But now I see another kind of cell that's kind of in a beige color, at least to my eye, off-white color. This is a support cell. And we see that it wraps itself around an axon. So if we look at cross-section, here's a cross-section of the axon. We can see this cell has many, many layers wrapped around it. And in the peripheral nervous system, this is going to be called a Schwann cell. Yeah, with two N's. A Schwann cell named after somebody that first described it and saw it underneath a microscope. And a Schwann cell does not run down the whole length of an axon, but an axon will contain many of these because Schwann cells are just microscopic. But remember, an axon could be as long as a meter, so you have to have thousands of these Schwann cells to completely cover an axon. And there's a gap between Schwann cells. That gap is what we call a node of Ranvier. And that has a particular function that we're going to talk about. And a Schwann cell wraps itself around an axon because it acts like insulation. And it keeps the electricity inside the axon as opposed to letting it jump out of the axon. Right? And the Schwann cell also inhibits some membrane proteins that are put into the cell membrane right here. And remember we said that a dendrite receives signals because what kind of channel does it have? You're going to have to go back and look in your notes because I want you to know what those are on the tip of your tongue. A ligand-gated channel, okay? But the axon is the sending end of a neuron because it doesn't have ligand-gated channels. It has voltage-gated channels, and we're going to discuss these things. Right, but underneath the Schwann cell, there aren't voltage-gated channels. There's voltage-gated channels only in the nodes of Ranvier. So we're going to have to piece this together over the next couple of days. All right, so a Schwann cell is a support cell, and it acts like insulation because it modifies a lipid, and a lipid is an insulator. The name of that lipid is called myelin. And so since myelin is making a sheath around this axon, sometimes we call these Schwann cells, the myelin sheath around an axon. And we're going to look and see how this works, the mechanism. But what it does, it speeds up the rate of a nerve impulse down an axon. So if you have a nice myelinated axon, it's fast. If it's a non-myelinated axon, it's slow. Okay, so what kind of neurons would you like to have in your body? Fast ones or slow ones? Let's pretend a bus is coming right at you. Lost control, and this bus is coming at you. Fast axons or slow axons? Fast axons, much better, right? So that's an advantage to have myelinated axons because they're faster. You can transmit information under great distances faster. All right, and a Schwann cell, where do we find Schwann cells? What part of the nervous system? Peripheral nervous system, right? So we can break nervous system down into central and peripheral. There's only one other kind of cell that we find in the peripheral nervous system, and that's a satellite cell. And if I have a picture of it, maybe I will show you, but I don't have a picture of it, okay? But maybe from anatomy, you can kind of remember. Picture a spinal cord. And there are ways for signals to enter the spinal cord and ways to leave the spinal cord. Do you remember something called a root? There's a dorsal root and a ventral root. And one of those roots has a bulge on it. Can you remember which root has a bulge on it? Yeah, the dorsal root, and we call it the dorsal root ganglia, and that is properly named because it's actually part of the peripheral nervous system. So in that dorsal root ganglia, there's an accumulation of nerve cell bodies of those pseudo unipolar neurons, right? And surrounding every cell body will be numerous satellite cells surrounding the cell body of that pseudo unipolar neuron. So when people first started looking at them underneath the microscope, they look like satellites around a planet. They look like moons around Jupiter or something like that. So they call them satellite cells. They just completely surround the cell body of a pseudo unipolar neuron, even though I don't have one to show you right here. All right, so you got two kinds of support cells in the central nervous system. Here you see an example of how a myelin sheath is wrapped around an axon. So here you have myelin in this part of the cell, and of course this is a living cell, it's a Schwann cell, wraps itself around, myelin is left in this layer right here, and then all of the cytoplasm is squished to this end of the cell. And then after the cell completely develops, you have all these layers of myelin, and then the outermost layer right here contains all the cytoplasm of the cell because it's a living cell. It doesn't have a lot of myelin, but it contains all the cytoplasm, which includes the nucleus and mitochondria and all the organelles. That cytoplasmic part of the Schwann cell is what we call the neurolemma. The neurolemma is this outer wrapping of a Schwann cell that contains all the living components inside of a normal cell. All right, that's the neurolemma. Okay, and it acts to electrically insulate an axon so that electricity can't move from the extracellular space into an axon or from the axon into the extracellular space. That can only happen in the nodes of Ranvier. Okay. All right, so let's move away from peripheral nervous system and move into central nervous system. This might sort of be a review from anatomy. Maybe you could recall this figure. All right, so here is an example of some cells we're going to find in what part of your body? But I want some specific examples. Like where? It says CNS. That's code for brain and spinal cord. Yeah, so that's different than peripheral nervous system. All right, so here I see that nice gold-colored cell. This looks like a nice multipolar neuron, right? But that's not what we're talking about. We want to look at the other cells that are here, and these are the neuroglia cells within the central nervous system. And we see four different kinds of cells. Peripheral nervous system, we talked about two. The first one in the peripheral nervous system we talked about was a Schwann cell that made a myelin sheath around an axon. If we look at the central nervous system, we see cells that do pretty much the same thing. Okay, but we don't call them Schwann cells. We call these oligodendrocytes because this oligodendrocyte has a number of processes on it. Okay, and these processes kind of look like dendrites, and so we call this an oligodendrocyte. An oligodendrocyte does not transmit electrical impulses like a neuron, okay, but it forms a myelin sheath that speeds up the rate of an impulse down an axon within the central nervous system. So that's one of its primary function, and it does so by utilizing a special chemical. What's the name of that chemical? Myelin, right, which is a lipid molecule and an insulator. Okay, and the difference between a Schwann cell and an oligodendrocyte, a couple different differences, but structurally you can see that a single oligodendrocyte can myelinate numerous axons because of the processes, but a Schwann cell can only myelinate one axon. It doesn't have any processes, doesn't have any dendritic processes. So that's a big difference. Another big difference is that in our brain, our body is very concerned about maintaining the proper number of neurons and to make sure that neurons don't grow uncontrollably. What happens if there are neurons in our brain that grow uncontrollably? What does that produce? Yeah, cancer, like a tumor, cancer cells inside the brain. So oligodendrocytes also inhibit the growth of neurons inside the central nervous system. So when the nervous system becomes damaged due to trauma, maybe you cut an axon in the spinal cord or the brain, it does not regenerate because of the activity of these oligodendrocytes that prevent proliferation and regeneration. And the reason why it does that is really to protect the health of the brain from uncontrolled growth. Schwann cells, on the other hand, do not secrete any inhibiting substances. They actually secrete growth factors so that when you damage a peripheral nerve, there's a good chance that it will grow back and re-innervate its target tissue. Okay, so that's why nerves in the peripheral nervous system can regenerate because they have Schwann cells, while nerves in the central nervous system typically do not regenerate because there are oligodendrocytes that form the myelin sheath. Unless we can figure out a way to change the mind of these oligodendrocytes, that would be really nice, because then we could rehabilitate somebody's central nervous system when it was damaged, but we don't know how to quite do that just yet. All right, so that's one kind of cell. oligodendrocyte. Another kind is an astrocyte. And an astrocyte has a number of processes on it, and we see some of these processes attached to the cell body, and maybe some dendrites and even an axon. Okay, and another process from the same astrocyte is attaching to a blood vessel right here. And this particular blood vessel is specialized for exchange. It's a capillary, right? It's designed to deliver nutrients and remove waste products from the brain. And an astrocyte then will put a bunch of these processes around the capillary to prevent the movement of materials from the capillary into the brain. So it's a way of regulating material in the blood from entering into the brain. So that protects the health of the brain. All right, so the astrocyte imports important nutrients into the brain, but excludes toxins and other kinds of harmful materials that would hurt the function of the brain. And how important is your brain? Would you like for me to just like flick a switch right now and have your brain turn off? That would be terrible, right? So if you ate some kind of poison in a salad or a hamburger or whatever you ate that could affect your brain, that would be really bad. So it's the job of these astrocytes right here to coat this lining of a capillary and produce something we call a blood-brain barrier. So that prevents many substances that are found in the blood from gaining access to the brain. Okay, and that includes many beneficial drugs that somebody might want to take to combat some kind of process that's happening in their brain. And pharmacy companies have to design drugs that can actually get around this blood-brain barrier so it can have access to the brain. So that's a really important barrier. All right, but an astrocyte can also take helpful compounds that can be used to make ATP. What kind of compound do you know that's a good precursor or an energy molecule for making ATP? Yeah, glucose in particular is really good. Astrocytes can specifically take up glucose and transport it via exoplasmic flow to the neuron right here. So it's a special delivery system, and it gets around that blood-brain barrier delivering important metabolites to neurons. Astrocytes can also secrete compounds that tell neurons how to interact with each other. Right, by growing different kinds of processes like dendrites and bifurcations off of axons. So astrocytes develop the architecture of the network of nerves inside our central nervous system. So astrocytes, as far as I know, and it might not really be true, so I don't know if this is true or not, so this is hypothesis on my part, but I don't think an astrocyte can tell this neuron right here to proliferate and grow into numerous cells, right? So it can't cause the number of cells in your brain to change, but it can cause how these cells interact with each other by growing different processes, right? So astrocytes do change the architecture of our brain by making different connections or interconnections between neurons, but not by increasing or decreasing the number of neurons that are in our brain. Right, it's just the kinds of connections. So, and that's associated with learning. Right, as we learn something, then neurons make new connections, physical connections with each other, so that they can share information and process information differently. But the number of neurons stays the same. So, guess what that means? When a neuron changes shape, guess what it's doing? It's changing its function. That's right. So when you take a nice chemistry class or good English literature class or maybe even a physiology class that is rigorous, guess what's happening to your brain? The structure of your brain is actually changing. Your neurons are moving and growing and learning how to make new connections, and that's what you have to practice on your own, right? All your study techniques are just figuring out ways to make all these new connections inside your brain, and that's partly due to the job of these astrocytes right here. All right, so astrocytes help make the blood-brain barrier. They deliver nutrients to neurons, and they help determine what the proper architecture is of these neurons here based on a person's activity level. Right, so if you never use your brain, guess what happens? Yeah, the brain atrophies. And if you use your brain a lot, what happens to it? Well, it grows. It gets smarter. And guess what a brain really likes to do? It likes to grow. It does not like to atrophy. Even though maybe tonight at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're studying, you say, oh, my brain feels like atrophying. It really doesn't. Okay. Okay, so you got oligodendrocytes that speed up the rate of an electrical impulse. You got astrocytes, okay, that help determine what the architecture of the brain is to deliver nutrients and to keep toxins in the blood, keep them from entering the brain tissue, the brain itself. And then you have these microglia cells. Microglia cells are kind of like a Langerhans cell or a dendritic cell that we find in the integument. They're kind of like a white blood cell, and they fight infection. That's what their job is. So their job is immune response. It helps fight infection due to a viral infection of the brain, bacterial infection of the brain, fungal infection of the brain, and even tumors. Okay, so we have our immune system that are constantly fighting tumors everywhere in our body. So everybody in here has cancer someplace in their body. Okay. The interesting thing is that since we have a functional immune system, that cancer doesn't get out of control. And if it doesn't get out of control, you never notice it. And if you never notice it, what's the significance? It's totally insignificant for you, right? So that's why most of us cancer is totally insignificant, but every once in a while a cancer cell figures out a way to defeat the immune system, and then it becomes a problem for that individual. Okay. So that's the job of these astrocytes right here. The fourth kind of cell is what we call an ependymal cell. And ependymal cells form a lining between the brain and ventricles. And the ventricles are chambers deep inside the brain that contain cerebrospinal fluid. And cerebrospinal fluid and the ventricular system have a number of different functions in that if you were to take a scale and weigh yourself, like right here in class, and then take a scale, put it in a pool, and stand on that scale in a pool, where would you weigh more? Would you weigh the same or different, whether you're standing in this room or in a pool? You'd weigh a lot more in the room because when you're in a pool, you'd have buoyancy, and that helps float you up off of the scale. Right, so when your brain is floating in the cerebrospinal fluid, effectively it weighs a little bit less. Right, so that's just one way to help control the structure of your brain, because your brain doesn't have any bones, doesn't have any muscles. It has these fluid chambers that helps maintain the shape. All right, and also helps absorb and distribute shock, so that different parts of the brain aren't traumatized. Right, so it's a shock-absorbing system. It helps float the brain. But it also helps regulate ions within the brain itself. And some important ions would be like what? Potassium and sodium and other kinds of ions. The cells that secrete cerebrospinal fluid are these ependymal cells. Right? When they combine with a capillary, we call that a choroid plexus. So we have ependymal cells that cover every part of a ventricle, and in some locations of a ventricle, it joins with capillaries to make a choroid plexus, which then secretes cerebrospinal fluid, which contains the proper concentrations of ions to maintain proper brain function. All right, so all of these cells right here you see in the central nervous system. All right, here is, now this cell that I'm looking at right here kind of looks like an eyeball, but it's not. Where would you find this cell? Central nervous system, because it's an oligodendrocyte. Okay, so we've looked at that one already. Okay, so here we have Schwann cells. Where would we find this neuron right here, or in particular this axon? In the peripheral nervous system, because that's where you find Schwann cells. So the function of a Schwann cell and the function of an oligodendrocyte are the same. It speeds up the rate of an electrical impulse down an axon. Okay, axon regeneration. We talked about this a little bit already. It occurs more readily in the peripheral nervous system than central nervous system because why? You could just tell me the names of two different cells. The peripheral nervous system has Schwann cells. Central nervous system has oligodendrocytes, right? Oligodendrocytes secrete an inhibitor that blocks the regrowth of an axon, while the Schwann cell actually promotes the regrowth of an axon in the peripheral nervous system. And this is how it works. All right, so here we have a nice motor neuron. The axon is going to be in the peripheral nervous system if this is a motor neuron. What's another name for motor neuron? What's another name for motor? Efferent, yeah, efferent. You got that right. I wouldn't say somatic. Somatic just refers to skeletal muscle, but in this particular case, because there's a skeletal muscle here, you could have said somatic motor neuron, okay, as opposed to visceral. Here we have Schwann cells. If this neuron is damaged, right, in a nerve, you're going to have thousands of these neurons all pointed in the same direction if it's an efferent pathway. And if that axon is cut, okay, then the part distal to the cut degenerates and is resorbed by your body, okay, including the Schwann cells. And then these little fragments of Schwann cells regenerate themselves, right, and secrete substances. They regenerate themselves into forming a tunnel. So here's a tunnel that's formed with many Schwann cells, and we call this the regeneration tube. Then the Schwann cells of regeneration tubes secrete trophic factors, which then guide the growth or the regrowth of this axon terminus to its effector organ. All right, so nerve regeneration in the peripheral nervous system does happen, not overnight, but it can happen because it has Schwann cells that secrete these trophic factors, and it also regenerates the regeneration tube first. Well, oligodendrocytes, on the other hand, don't form a regeneration tube, but it actually secretes inhibiting factors so that axons do not regenerate in the central nervous system. Neurotrophins are things secreted by astrocytes and maybe some other kinds of nerve cells that promote the growth of the nervous system, especially in the fetus. And we also believe that neurotrophins are even important in the adult in order to maintain a healthy brain and a brain that is plastic, that means a brain that can change and learn, okay, require neurotrophins. And when somebody is deficient in neurotrophins, then unfortunately their brain loses its nimbleness. It has difficulty adjusting to new circumstances. And I kind of relate this to a clinical condition of depression. Patients that are depressed have a difficulty dealing with new stimuli, especially if it's disturbing stimuli. And there are parts of the brain that are deficient in these neurotrophins that help them respond to new and challenging kinds of information and circumstances. So neurotrophins are important. These are secreted by those astrocytes again. So people were very interested in neurons because that's the functional block of the nervous system transmitting information, but now people are very interested in glial cells because they help the neurons do their job. Okay. All right, so here is just a synopsis of that astrocyte again. It helps regulate potassium levels, right? It secretes neurotrophin, so it regulates neurogenesis. And it can release transmitter that regulate neuronal activity, or just the activity of this neuron right here. And then it also does something else, which we haven't talked about yet, and that is the recycling of neurotransmitters. I think we've talked about a synapse in here. And a synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, and there are two different kinds of synapses. There's a chemical synapse and electrical synapse. Did I talk about that in this class yet? Anybody remember? Gap junctions, electrical synapse? Maybe I didn't. Okay, well, I will one of these days. Here is an example of a chemical synapse. And a chemical synapse is a way for the top cell to communicate with the bottom cell. So there's a space between these cells right here. So there is information in the top cell that's being transmitted as an electrical signal. That electrical signal can't hop across the space to excite the cell on the bottom, okay? It can't, because there's too much resistance in this space, unless it was a lightning bolt, but our bodies don't use lightning bolts to transmit electrical information. So that electrical information in the top neuron has to be converted into a chemical signal that we call a neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter is released. Right, it diffuses to the bottom cell, which then starts another electrical signal in the bottom cell, and away it goes through the second cell. So that's what we call a chemical synapse. Chemical synapse uses an electrical signal to start a chemical signal, which then starts another electrical signal in the second cell. So since this is a synapse, the top cell sometimes we call the presynaptic cell. And here's the presynaptic membrane. The bottom cell is after the synapse, so sometimes we call that the postsynaptic cell. The postsynaptic cell does not release neurotransmitter, only the presynaptic cell. And in order for the presynaptic cell to be able to control the postsynaptic cell, what does the postsynaptic cell have to have? It's got to have receptor. And I see these receptors, they're not labeled on your diagram, but I see them in there. Okay. And since they have receptors, then this dendrite right here is going to be the receiving end of a neuron. And so these receptors, I can see a little tunnel going through them. These are channels for ions. And what kind of channels does a dendrite have, or the receiving end of a neuron? If it doesn't ring a bell, that's okay, because we're just going to keep repeating it until you know what it is. It's called a ligand-gated channel. It's a ligand-gated channel because the neurotransmitter has to bind to the receptor before that channel opens or closes, and when it does, it changes the electrical properties of the postsynaptic cell. Okay, a lot of information. So you see astrocytes, even though they don't transmit electrical information, they help the communication and regulate the communication between cells because astrocytes can take this neurotransmitter, right, and recycle it back into the presynaptic neuron. So that's really important for controlling the activity of the synapse. So astrocytes control synaptic transmission because of its activity on neurotransmitter, the recycling of neurotransmitters. Blood-brain barrier, also important function of astrocytes. Right, we talked about that already. So we're done talking about different cells of the nervous system, the neuroglia cells versus the neurons and where they're found and what some of their jobs are. Okay, any questions on that? That's kind of a review from anatomy, sort of. We didn't talk about astrocyte function in a lot of detail in anatomy, though. Okay, membrane potential. Ooh, what is that talking about? Okay, so it's a cell membrane. We know what that is. That's just from anatomy. What's this potential thing mean? That just means voltage, right? So there's some kind of separation of electrical charge across the membrane, and we call that a membrane potential because what do opposite charges like to do? They attract each other so that they can neutralize each other to become absolutely neutral so that there's not positive or negative charge someplace. So if there's potential, that means then that you have a separation of charge and these separate charges are just dying to get together to neutralize each other. That's a potential energy. That's a source of energy. So that's why we call it a potential, and you could call it a voltage if you want to. And we talked about the resting membrane potential, how it developed inside cells, and I'm just going to call it RMP from now on. All right, so at rest, cells have a negative internal charge and an unequal distribution of ions, and we saw that it was due to large, okay, it says cations on this slide, but guess what? It is anions, right? And an anion is what kind of charge? Negative, right? So DNA and proteins are negatively charged, so you have this big accumulation of negative charge inside the cell, and these are huge molecules, they cannot leave, so you have all these negative charges trapped inside the cell as well. The sodium-potassium pump also helps maintain RMP. Okay, because what can you tell me about when sodium gets pumped out, what can you tell me about sodium being pumped in? The number of molecules. It's 3 sodiums being pumped out, but only 2 potassiums being pumped in. These are charged molecules. So what happens to the charge across the membrane if you're pumping out more positive charges? The outside of the cell becomes more positive, which means another way of saying that is that the inside of the cell becomes more negative. It means exactly the same thing, right? Just because they're opposite. And the membrane potential is also due to permeability of ions. We didn't deal with this very much in this class, but we're going to start to deal with it now a little bit. So the membrane potential changes when ions can move across the membrane, and we call that permeability. And remember, ions by themselves cannot move across the cell membrane because, what can you tell me about the structure, especially the internal structure of a cell membrane? It's hydrophobic. Yeah, it's made out of fatty acids, right? And sodium and potassium are charged compounds. So these are what? Hydrophilic compounds. A hydrophilic compound can't get through a cell membrane unless there's a channel that opens up to allow it to move through the cell membrane. All right, so sodium and potassium like to be in water, not lipid. All right, so Neurons are excitable, right, which means that they can discharge their resting membrane potential rapidly by changing permeability across the cell membrane to various ions. And we're going to look at what some of those ions are. And there are two kinds of cells in your body that do this regularly. Neurons is one, but also muscles. So muscles share a characteristic that's similar to a neuron. Muscles are excitable. It has ligand-gated channels. Muscles also can conduct what we call action potentials because it has voltage-gated channels just like an axon does. Then you're going to be really proud of yourself when you can see the similarity between neurons and muscles in just a little bit. Okay, so how are we going to measure some of this activity? We have something almost like this in lab. This is a fancy voltmeter, but instead of reading voltage as a number or on a dial, we can actually see it as a curve on the face of this TV screen. And this TV screen right here is called an oscilloscope. And this oscilloscope has two leads to it. It has two electrical wires coming from it. And it can measure the voltage difference between these two different places of these wires. All right, so if the voltage becomes positive, then this little trace will go up. If it becomes negative, this little trace on the oscilloscope will go down. And we put these two different wires in two different locations with respect to the cell, and you can see one wire is inside the cell, and the other wire is outside, so we're measuring the voltage across what? Across the cell membrane, the voltage that's inside the cell compared to the outside. And remember, in a living cell, the voltage on the inside is going to be negative with respect to the outside. A couple of ways to think about that is why, because you have a lot of negative charges trapped inside the cell. Another way to think about it is because you kick more sodiums out than you bring potassiums in, right? That makes the outside more positive. All right, so at rest, the cell is negative on the inside, if it's a living cell. Right, which means if there's a voltage difference across the cell, every cell acts like a battery. And it's working mostly because that sodium ATP pump is doing its job. All right, so if we put these electrodes across the membrane, we can measure the voltage across the cell membrane, and we see it on this slide right here. So on the vertical axis, we have millivolts. That's a small voltage. That's about 1/1000th of a volt. Right, it's easy to measure, but it's a little bit small. If this is a living cell, the inside is going to be negative, so it's not going to be at zero. What kind of cell is going to have a zero membrane potential? Yeah, a dead cell, right? Just like if you have a battery at 0 volts, it's dead, right? Okay, and in order to develop that voltage, okay, to make the inside negative, what does a cell have to have? Primary active transport, that's a hint, is what? Sodium-potassium ATP pump, okay? So if a cell has ATP, it's probably alive because it can maintain this voltage. If it doesn't have ATP, then this voltage goes away and that cell is going to die. That's kind of just another way of thinking about how important ATP is. So here is a cell, and there's a membrane potential, resting membrane potential. It's at about minus 70 millivolts, as we can see on the computer screen or oscilloscope screen right here. So what can you tell me about this cell? It's got ATP, it's alive, it's pumping sodium and potassium, and it's not at equilibrium because it's negative on the inside compared to the outside. Right? And if we don't do anything to that cell, then it's just going to stay at minus 70, hence we call that a resting membrane potential. It is not changing. At rest, the membrane potential doesn't change. But the cell is excitable. We can change the membrane potential doing a number of different tricks. Right, we can force that voltage, or we can change the voltage so that it goes from minus 70 to minus 60, from minus 60 to minus 40, to minus 40 to zero. All right, so what's happening to the membrane potential? It's decreasing. That's decreasing. The magnitude is decreasing, even though it's becoming less negative. We say that is decreasing. We call that depolarization. When the voltage goes away, we call that depolarization. Even if it goes from a negative to zero, that's depolarization. Or if it goes from zero above, we call that depolarization too. Anything in this direction, the upward direction, we call depolarization. And you're going to be familiar with that as a excitatory event, as stimulation. All right, so depolarization is a stimulation or an excitatory event. We can go back to resting membrane potential. And we can make that potential move farther away from zero. We call that hyperpolarization, because now there's more voltage across the membrane. Right? So as the membrane potential becomes more negative and more negative, we call that hyperpolarization. And even though it's moving away from zero right here, we call that inhibition. So hyperpolarization inhibits a neuron. It's not excitatory, it is inhibitory. So these are just some definitions that you have to become familiar with. Right? And we can use an oscilloscope or a voltmeter to measure these things. All right, so for instance, if we depolarize a neuron, how do we get it back to resting membrane potential? We repolarize it. Okay, so if after depolarization, to get back to RMP, you have to repolarize. And if you go beyond resting membrane potential down into this region right here, you call that hyperpolarization. You're making the voltage even bigger, even though it's in a negative direction. Okay. All right, so membrane potential changes occur by flow of ions through membrane channels. So you can think of these as, since it's a flow of ions, what is it also a flow of? It's a flow of electrical charge or electricity, right? And it's controlled by flow of ions. And what are some of your favorite ions? Sodium and potassium, right? And those are just monovalent cations. All right, some channels are normally open, but most are normally closed. There are some potassium channels that are always open. We call these leakage channels. Okay, so let's go back to the previous slide. All right, so let's just say we're at RMP, and there is a potassium leak channel that's open. Okay, what's going to happen to the membrane potential? What's the charge of potassium? Positive. Where is it found? Inside the cell, right? So it's maintaining kind of a positive charge inside the cell. If you let it leak out, what happens to the membrane potential? As a cell loses positive charge, what happens to the membrane potential? It becomes more negative because the cell is losing positive charge. All right, so that potassium leakage helps maintain resting membrane potential away from equilibrium. Okay. Closed channels have molecular gates that can be opened or closed depending on conditions. And there are two kinds. There's voltage-gated channels and ligand-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels are opened by depolarization. This is a good place to start. Okay, because when you change the voltage across the membrane, that voltage-gated channel has, that protein has charges on the protein. And when the charges inside the cell and outside the cell change, then that protein is going to be pulled and tugged in a little bit different way due to that electrostatic interaction between charges in the extracellular fluid and the cytoplasm and charges on the protein. So the protein changes shape depending on what the voltage across the membrane is. And we're going to call that a voltage-gated channel. And a lot of voltage-gated channels become open when a cell starts to depolarize. All right, so when a cell membrane starts to depolarize, ion channels open, and that is an excitatory or stimulation on the cell. All right, depolarization is stimulatory. Voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells. Okay, but for instance, if one were to be opened, let's go back to this slide right here. If we were to open a voltage-gated channel, what would happen to the resting membrane potential? Potassium would leave the cell, and when potassium leaves the cell, what happens to the voltage? The voltage inside the cell becomes more negative, and that's hyperpolarization. So when potassium channels are open, that's an inhibition of the cell. When sodium channels are open, that causes depolarization, that's excitatory. When potassium channels are open, that hyperpolarizes the cell, that acts as an inhibition. Okay. I might have to talk about that more than just one time for you to have a nice clear picture, but if you want to talk to me during office hours, I'll be glad to, or your lab instructors. All right, so you want to be familiar with that. Sodium channels are voltage gated, closed in resting cells. All right, so let's review. How many different kinds of ion channels are there? We can break them down into how many categories? There are two categories. There's ligand gated channels that has a receptor site that is going to sense a receptor or a ligand, a neurotransmitter, which is a ligand. And then you have voltage-gated channels that can open or close depending on the voltage across the membrane. Because all these protons, all these proteins, and here we have an ice cell membrane, here's a protein. Proteins have charge on them. All right, so let's just say we have a bunch of positive charges on this protein right here, and you have a bunch of negative charges inside the cell, then the inside of the cell is going to be pulling on the protein because it has a positive charge. But what happens if we change a charge inside the cell from negative to positive? Instead of pulling on this protein, it's going to like push on it the other way, which is going to change a conformation of this protein. So here's a protein that is a channel. It's closed, all right? But if we change it, by changing the voltage across the membrane, then it's going to change conformation, and now the channel is open. And since it's a channel that's open, then ions can move down their electrochemical gradient. It can move by diffusion or by electrical charge. So let's just say that this is a nice sodium channel. Where do you have high sodium? Outside the cell. Okay, low sodium inside. So by diffusion, sodium wants to rush inside the cell when this channel opens. But what about for the electrical charge? Sodium is positive. What's on the inside of the cell? Negative, and what do? Attract each other. So you open this sodium channel, what's going to happen to sodium? It's going to rush in because of the concentration gradient, but also because of the electrical gradient. We call that the potential, the membrane potential. Okay, and this protein can change configuration depending on the voltage across the membrane. All right, there's something else that can happen too. If we change the membrane potential, so here is what the protein looks like at RMP, resting membrane potential. We depolarize the membrane, which is excitatory event, right? It's stimulatory. Membrane potential starts to depolarize. It changes the conformation in this protein. Now sodium can enter the cell. And of course, that's drastically going to change the membrane potential, all right, when sodium enters. And then after a while, the second little protein that's part of the channel, you can see it kind of looks like a chain and a ball, all of a sudden can get sucked up into this opening right here, and it can plug the sodium channel. And if it plugs the sodium channel, what can you tell me about sodium? Can't get through. Can't get through the cell membrane, right? Because the cell membrane here is hydrophobic. Okay. And so we call this an inactivation gate. And an inactivation gate can effectively close this channel even though it is still open, right? But it can happen very quickly. So these channels have, well, they have this channel that can open and close depending on the voltage across the membrane, and then there is this inactivation gate, right, which can shut off that flow of sodium into the cell very quickly, and even maybe some other ions like potassium. All right, so this is a good model of a voltage-gated channel that you should be aware of. And I know you guys want to talk about an action potential because you got to draw this in lab, all right? But this is where we got to start next time, and this is crucial for your understanding in physiology, so that's why I want you to be able to draw this figure out just from your memory on a blank piece of paper and understand everything, all right? So next time, come with a lot of questions because we're going to talk about this thing. And don't forget, the sign-in sheet is going around right now. Where's the sign? Wave this. Very good. Thank you. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet so I know you are here.